The talk here is in four parts. I'm going to start off with some remarks from Bob about indexicals. And in a sense, the whole talk is a kind of response, well, a kind of filling out of something I said to Bob in Prague 4 years ago in the context of discussion following one of his repeat John Locke lectures there, where I said that I thought that there was an important sense in which causation was just like indexicals, and the lessons which seem obvious in that case ought to be applied in the case of causation too. Eleni, I think we're getting a little bit of feedback here. Could we have the volume down slightly? Thanks. Okay, so let's start off with some remarks from Bob. This is from a paper whose name will appear at the end of the quote, which I forget at the moment. Bob says, as a somewhat fanciful example of how a representational semantic paradigm can mislead us, consider someone who is puzzled about what is represented by indexical vocabulary. Are there indexical facts over and above those expressible in non-indexical terms? If not, why aren't indexical terms freely interchangeable with non-indexical ones, as Perry's essential indexical shows us that they're not? And if so, what are these peculiar items? One might imagine, Bob says, one might imagine here some naturalistic analogue of the theologians who worried that a deity who's not spatio-temporally located could not think the sort of indexical and demonstrative thoughts we express using here, now, and this. And there's the title of the paper, Global Anti-Representationalism. And Bob goes on to point out that there's really no deep puzzle here at all. This is how we dispel it. I'm not now sure whether I'm quoting from the same paper or from one of the Locke lectures. My quotes here come from both. But the point is the same. It's just filled out at greater length in the Locke lecture. So Bob says, the fact that we can formulate rules sufficient to specify the correct use of indexicals, at least for ordinary spatio-temporally located speakers, including the uses that are demonstrably not interchangeable with the use of any non-indexical terms. The fact we can do that entirely in non-indexical terms should be enough to dispel any concern that there's something spooky or mysterious going on, the kind of things that could require special indexical facts. If the practices themselves are all in order from a naturalistic point of view, any difficulties we might have in specifying the kinds of things those engaged in the practices are talking about, how they're representing the world as being, ought to be laid at the feet of a Procrustean semantic paradigm that insists the only model for understanding meaningfulness is a representational one. Okay, so my project here is to try to generalize this metaphysical puzzle dispelling line of thought by generalizing the feature, that is locality, on which the indexical case depends. So just to fill the story, the indexical story out a little bit more, here's Bob's gloss on what he calls the Anscombe-Perry thesis, sort of linking the ideas that are familiar from Perry's essential indexicals to some points made by Anscombe. Bob says, indexicals play a special role in the behavioral economies of their users. They can have a motivational significance that's not reproduced by non-indexical expressions. That the meeting is starting now, that the bear is going to eat me, that the treasure is buried here, are sayings that can immediately move me to do things that I need not be similarly motivated to do by the realization that the meeting starts at noon, the bear is going to eat Bob, the treasure is buried at XYZ, even if those are the non-indexical specifications of the very indices that characterize my utterance. Okay, here's a picture of Bob showing me precisely where the bear is going to eat him. Thank you, Bob. Nonetheless, we can formulate rules sufficient to specify the correct use of indexicals, at least for ordinary spatio-temporally located speakers, entirely in non-indexical terms. So again, there's no puzzle. But it seems to me that at a couple of points, Bob draws what I think is slightly the wrong lessons from this kind of exchange, this puzzle dispelling exchange. And I just want to flag those two points because they're relevant to what I want to say later. He says, what does this meaning use analysis tell us? It shows us that and how anyone who knows how to use non-indexical vocabulary already knows how to do everything else she needs to in principle to deploy indexical vocabulary, even though what is expressed by indexical vocabulary cannot be fully expressed by non-indexical vocabulary. There's nothing about the use of indexicals that must remain hidden from the view of one who professes to know his way around only the non-indexical fragment of language. And what I want to take issue there is the anyone claim, and I'll come back to that. Secondly, Bob says it may be that no one actually boggles at indexical vocabulary in a way that would make this analysis dispositive of an urgent problem rather than just generally enlightening. Indexical skepticism is certainly not widespread, and it's hard for me to see how this account could help those theologians who really are worried about the apparent inability of a non-spatiotemporal deity to think indexical thoughts. And what I want to say about that is that the interesting imaginary opponent here isn't the indexical skeptic. We're all skeptics about special indexical facts, or almost all of us, if you leave aside some people who think that in the temple case we do have something like that. Otherwise, we're all skeptics. We take it for granted that there aren't kind of special eye and hear facts. So the interesting imaginary opponent isn't the skeptic. It's the person on the other side. It's the person who's some kind of big R realist about indexical facts. That's the person whose kind of puzzle is dispelled by this story. Okay, but saying something first about the first of those points, the anyone point. The meaning use analysis specifies rules for the use of indexical vocabulary in terms of the location of the speaker in three main modalities: where, when, and who she is. And here's one of these little red dots that you find on maps, which I particularly like because it calls our attention to all three of these modalities. But it seems to me that contrary to Bob's claim in the passages I gave you above, the analysis doesn't show how anyone who, as Bob puts it, knows how to use non-indexical vocabulary already knows how to do everything she needs to do to deploy indexical vocabulary. Certainly anyone who has a location in these three respects, but we can imagine languages spoken by intelligences who do not, as Bob's own theological example illustrates. So imagine trying to teach the ordinary indexicals to a speaker who lacks a temporal, spatial, or personal location. It simply can't be done because that person doesn't have what it takes to employ the usage rules concerned. Of course, one might teach such a speaker to speak as if it occupied a particular location in each of these respects. But that's not a genuine unlocated use. It depends on an ability to imagine oneself in shoes which are located somewhere. So familiar indexical vocabulary already gives us three examples of classes of linguistic expressions that can only be used by creatures who are located in some respect, whether they have a temporal or a spatial or a personal location. And it's this notion of location that I want to try to generalize. But already, without leaving the indexical case, we've generalized the kind of canonic spatial version of that notion, spatial location, to two other modalities, the temporal and the personal one. And I want to try to generalize it a lot further by moving beyond the indexical case as usually understood. So by finding other expressions which appear to be usable only by suitably located creatures, expressions which share with the ordinary indexicals the property of having a distinctive kind of pragmatic significance which depends on those locations in the generalized sense. And a bit of notation, I'm going to use the term location with a double L, the Welsh spelling for generalized location. And here's a pronunciation guide, which I can kind of describe it. I don't think I can properly kind of illustrate it for you. You see, in Welsh, the double L represents the voiceless alveolar lateral fricative, a sound with no English equivalent. It's similar to the voiceless L in please, but with considerably more friction. So if you'd all like to practice them. Okay. So what are we looking for in these cases? First of all, what we're looking for is something which generalizes the Anscombe Perry thesis by finding other cases in which we can't replace located vocabularies with unlocated ones because the latter lack the practical associations of the pragmatic significance of the former in some respect. Secondly, we're looking for cases where we can generalize the lesson that seems obvious in the indexical case, that the special role of the vocabulary in question is not to be explained in terms of the idea that it tracks it as its distinctive kind of fact. So we're looking for cases in which we can generalize the lesson that the direction of explanatory significance goes from the pragmatics to the facts, as it were. Again, this is picking up on things we were talking about yesterday. So the first task then is to think some more about why metaphysics is so obviously the wrong approach in the indexical case, so that we know what we're looking for in the other cases. And it seems to me there are three points that need flagging here. One of them, and the one which has the most direct connection to the kinds of things we were talking about yesterday, is that there's pretty clearly no explanatory role for indexical facts. And I think there are two elements to this. One is what I'll call here explanatory redundancy. So that's the fact in the indexical case that the special character of the indexical facts, that is the Anscombe-Perry thesis and the irreducibility of indexical language to non-indexical language, is fully explained without invoking any such additional metaphysical facts. So metaphysics is explanatorily redundant in that sense. The other is what I call explanatory inefficacy, which is not quite the right thing. It's the fact that, the sort of hypothesis in a particular case, that it's very unclear how any kind of metaphysical fact could possibly do the pragmatic work in question. So what kind of special fact could explain the practical relevance of indexical judgments? And we can kind of get a sense of the force of that by thinking about the one indexical case in which there are some people who claim to believe in some sort of indexical fact of this kind, namely the temporal case. So imagine someone who believes in the so-called moving spotlight view that says, well, one time is objectively distinguished as the now, from God's point of view, as it were. What's the practical relevance of that spotlight? How could we tell that it was shining on us? This is a point that people have made in the context of those discussions. But it's a kind of illustration of the general point I want to highlight here about explanatory inefficacy. Okay, so that's the first point, the point about explanation. The second point turns on variation, interspeaker variability. Another thing that's characteristic of the indexical case is that any kind of metaphysical picture would have trouble accommodating two kinds of variability between speakers, one of which is extremely evident in that case and one of which is much less so. The evident one I'll call intramodal variation. This is the case in which two speakers are both located in some respect but differ in their locations in that respect. So they both have spatial positions but different positions. Extramodal variation, on the other hand, is the case in which we have two speakers, one of whom has a location in a particular respect and the other of whom has no location in that respect. So again, the contrast between an ordinary located human speaker and an intelligence which has no spatial location. Perhaps it's distributed in the cloud, as it were, or the non-spatial, temporally located God. Okay. There's a footnote there about the relation between these two, but I'll skip over that. But so why is it that these kinds of variations are kind of problematic if you're trying to sort of put a metaphysical picture on top of the domain of linguistic practice, or to see it as underneath the domain of linguistic practice in a case of this kind? Well, here's a couple of reasons. If we're looking at intramodal variation, then it's going to provide a source of no-fault disagreement between speakers, so it's going to render implausible the idea that there's a single fact of the matter which they're all trying to track. Now, there's kind of certainly responses you can make here, like you can look at sort of relativized or contextualized facts, but there's an obvious response to those responses, which picks up from a remark of Bob's in the passages I quoted. I mean, isn't the need to think that we need facts of that kind just the Procustean paradigm at work again? Okay, I'm not going to explore that thought. I just wanted to have on the table the way in which intramodal variation represents a kind of challenge to a metaphysical picture. And then extramodal variation also represents a challenge, but a different one. It conflicts with the intuition that metaphysical facts should be trackable from nowhere, as it were, and shouldn't depend on access from a particular standpoint. Okay, and the other thing that I think we can use the indexical case to highlight is the possibility of what I call local factuality. What I mean by that is the indexical case demonstrates that among a group of speakers who share a location, perhaps a spatial location, as long as they have a word like here that does the indexical work with respect to that location, then disputes about where here is, where they are, can have all the character for them within their community of a dispute about a factual matter. And of course, it can't have that character if they don't have that term. So if they're like just like Perry's Zealanders, whose statements about the weather are always about the weather in Zealand, although they don't have a word for here or for Zealand, so they don't explicitly say that that's the case. That for them, that's not going to support this kind of local factual discourse that I'm talking about, simply because they don't have the terminology. But if they do have a notion of here, then within their group, discussions about where they are will have this locally factual character. Now, the reason this matters in the context here is that it alerts us to the possibility that variability can remain out of view when one's within a community which shares a location in the same respect. And that's very important when we're trying to generalize the notion of location, because we'll get to cases where for ordinary human communities, these things can be shared throughout the entire community. And we have to look beyond ordinary human communities to see the possibility of the kind of variability of location that's interesting. Okay, so, and that's important because the appearance that there's a genuine fact to the matter under dispute, as it were, is a major motivation for the kind of metaphysical approaches to which the indexical analogy provides an alternative. When I say in my title that indexicals are the tip of the iceberg, this is very much what I have in mind, that features which are true of discourses much more generally are just highly visible in the case of the indexicals. And that's particularly true of intramodal variability. Okay, so now let me run extremely quickly through a couple of examples before, in the last section of the talk, I get to the example I actually want to focus on, which is the case of causation. Okay, so color vocabulary, a very familiar example. I'm not going to argue for any of these points in detail, but I think the case is so familiar that it's easy to see how the argument would go. So here we have the link to something practical or practical ability, in this case, our color vision. We have variation, both intramodal and extramodal. So intramodal case is what's normally called color blindness. The extramodal case is ordinary blindness. We have intramodal variations in color vision between speakers as a possible source of no-fault disagreement. Though, in this case, the fact that there is, to a large extent, a kind of norm of what we think of as normally or properly functioning human vision acts to suppress that kind of no-fault disagreement. So what we actually get is a practice in which widespread shared location supports what I think is a very good example of the kind of local factuality I was talking about above. And this links in with some familiar kinds of Salazian lessons about the way in which the practice of making ascriptions of color properties kind of acts as a kind of corrective for naive color judgments. And here I'll just, with apologies to those of you who were here at our McDowell meeting this time last year, I'll just give you a couple of pictures from that context to kind of remind you of the familiar background here. So here's a Salazian scene. As I said last year, this particular Thai shop is is actually in Milan. It's sort of in the wonderful old sort of shopping mall between the Duomo and the and La Scala. That's there, obviously, just to remind you of Seller's famous discussion of the way in which the community corrects the initial color judgments of Jones, who works in the tie shop. It also gives us a kind of transition to another case, the case of taste. So if we think of the kind of facts which are on display for us in the lower portion of the previous scene, in this case, facts about what tie goes well with what shirt, I think it's highly plausible that these facts are second nature to well-brought-up Italians. But it's equally obvious to us that they're not second nature to, however much they may seem a matter of fact to well-brought-up Italians, they're not so to members of any conceivable community. Here's a counterexample. For example, see, this shows that even within a community as tightly constrained as Locke lecturers, we don't get agreement on facts of that kind. Okay, so in for taste as for color, we get these familiar marks of location in the generalized sense. We get variability, both intramodal and extramodal. We get no-fault disagreement, but local agreement given shared locality. We get links to practical abilities, in this case, perceptual and aesthetic sensibilities. So we get all the kinds of features that I flagged in the indexical case as being relevant to this issue about the status of metaphysics. But all the same, it seems to me that color and taste are not perfect examples for my purposes, in part because serious metaphysical realists about these issues are hard to find. Now, it's true that we can find plenty of people who say that they're realists about these issues, such as John Campbell in the case of color, or McDowell about, well, maybe not about taste specifically, but about closely related kinds of matters. But I think that's a different matter. The rather deflated notion of realism, which is which is kind of on the table in these cases, is fully compatible with local factuality. Okay, so just to flag one more example before I move on to the main one, and I'll run through this even more briefly. This is an interesting one because it's moving us in the direction of, as it were, the metaphysics of modality. It's the case of credence and probability. In this case, the way to apply the generalized notion of location, I think, is to say that to have a location is to be a decision maker under uncertainty. That is, to have credences where these are functionally defined in the usual way in terms of their role in a subjective decision theory to which the decision maker's behavior conforms, at least under idealization. So that's a familiar story about what it is to have a credence. And then in terms of that story, more precisely, a fully specified location would be a coherent assignment of credences to all of some range of propositions. So two agents differ in credal location if they assign different credences to the same proposition at some point. Now, if credal locations in this sense are made explicit in the form of judgments, it's probable at P, then interspeaker agreement, that is, shared credal location, supports a considerable degree of local factuality, as in the previous cases, with plenty of scope for Salazian objectification, as in the color case. So thus we can find ourselves tempted to say that such judgments aim to keep track of some distinctive kind of fact, the probability or the chance that P, but the reasons for resisting this temptation are much as in the indexical case, the explanatory irrelevance and inefficacy, and this is a very familiar point in discussions of things like the principle, people who have an excessively objective conception of chance have a lot of trouble explaining why our credences should be constrained by our knowledge of the chance. If you start at the pragmatic end, as arguably Lewis himself did, then you don't have this worry. Okay, so now let's get on to the case which is the one that interests me most and the one that I was originally interested in comparing to the indexicals. Here's something I'll call the Cartwright two-boxer thesis. is Cartwright's version of it. I want to propose this as an analog of the Anscombe-Perry thesis. Cartwright, in a famous paper called, what is it called? Somebody remind me. Causal Laws and Effective Strategies, from Noose in 1979. She argues that strategic decision-making requires that agents represent their world in causal terms rather than merely probabilistic terms. Without causal beliefs, in addition to probabilistic beliefs, she says, we lose a crucial distinction between effective and ineffective strategies for achieving our ends. Around about the same time, at the beginning of the 80s, there was a discussion in decision theory in which a lot of people who came to be called two boxers, argued that we need a distinction between causal beliefs and merely evidential beliefs in order to formulate a rational decision theory that gives the right answer in certain Newcomb-like decision problems. I'll focus mainly on Cartwright's version of the argument. Cartwright begins with Russell's claim from the famous Russell 1913 paper on the notion of a cause. Russell's claim that, as Cartwright puts it, laws of association are all the laws there are, and that causal principles cannot be derived from the causally symmetric laws of association. And she argues that she argues, as she puts it, in support of Russell's second claim, namely that the causal principles can't be derived from the laws of association, but against the first. She agrees with Russell that causal laws can't be, I've already said that, but she agrees they can't be reduced, but maintains they can't be done away with. And her case for the latter claim turns on the thesis that causal laws are needed to ground a distinction between effective and ineffective strategies. She says, causal laws can't be done away with because they're needed to ground this distinction between effective strategies and ineffective ones. The difference between the two depends on the causal laws of our universe and on nothing weaker. And almost everybody, certainly everybody I know except for Nancy herself, takes that conclusion to be a metaphysical one. So it's not a psychological point about what Bob called the behavioral economies of deliberating agents. It's supposed to be a point about what has to be in the world in order to ground this distinction between effective and ineffective strategies. So an argument for realism about causal powers. And that's rather interesting if you compare Perry's argument, which is actually in the same volume of Noose in 1979, and they were both at Stanford at the time. If you think of the strange combination of analogies and disanalogies we have between the two arguments. So the analogies are that Perry and Cartwright are both arguing that beliefs of one sort are not reducible to beliefs of another sort. So causal beliefs are not reducible to probabilistic beliefs, indexical beliefs are not reducible to non-indexical beliefs. And in both cases, the argument turns on the role that beliefs of the irreducible kind play in action. But the disanalogy is that the intended conclusions are quite different. So in one case, we have an argument for realism about causation. In the other, a point about the cognitive prerequisites of agency. So a natural question, it seems to me, is whether we can read Cartwright in a different way in order to make her point look a lot more like Perry's. And now I'm going to run through very briefly some territory which seems to me to be crucial to showing how to do that. So let's consider a typical simple decision. And I want to consider the kind of case which is supposed to raise problems for a merely probabilistic account of effective strategies. So it's a kind of Newcomb-like case. So here, imagine that we have you're facing a decision as to whether to smoke or not to smoke. Perhaps you believe that, if you smoke, you'll have nice bluey-green hands like that. If you don't smoke, you'll have these much darker ones. Perhaps you have some reason for wanting to have blue hands. So if that was the only consideration, then of course you go ahead and smoke. However, you also believe that in decision makers like yourself, the decision as to whether to smoke or not to smoke is correlated with possession of some gene, which also has nasty consequences via a different kind of causal route. So it tends to cause cancer. That's why there's a statistical association between cancer and smoking. So in my picture here, the correlated observable fact, so it's true in that case, false in that case, is possession of a gene. Okay. So that's the kind of case that Cartwright's argument appeals to. It's also the kind of case that causal decision theorist's claim shows that we need a causal decision theory rather than a merely evidential decision theory. Now, here's the crucial point. From the agent's point of view, as she decides whether to smoke or not smoke, her own action and its consequences are unpredictable. So I try to represent that here as a kind of fog. She can't assign credences to things within that foggy zone. Why is that? It's because, as some people put it, deliberation screens prediction. And the basic reason for that, as Janan has convinced me over many years now, is that choice is an epistemic trump. So whatever other reason you might have for assigning a credence to some fact in that zone, your choice automatically trumps it. So the relevance of that here is that if, as you decided whether to do S or not S, you thought this correlation still held between the observable fact and something within that zone, then you'd have a kind of window into the forbidden zone, because you simply look to see whether the fact was true or false, and that would give you an indication about what was going on in that forbidden zone there. Well, that means that from your point of view, as the agent making this decision, that correlation has to be broken. And there's a little note there pointing out that that's essentially the same kind of argument that's involved in the Bilking argument in the case of backward causation. And Dummett's famous point about backward causation is that you can believe that you've got it as long as you give up the idea that you can observe the effects before you decide how to act. And that's exactly that same correlation breaking requirement. And it seems to me that in that case, too, it's really grounded on the fact that choice acts as an epistemic trump. Okay, so the relevance of this, I think, is that the epistemics of deliberation already and automatically break the spurious correlations on which Cartwright's argument depends. And so you don't need causal facts to do the job. So just to run through that, the point is that an agent's credences about her own future actions differ from those of an otherwise similarly informed third person, because from her point of view, deliberation is an epistemic trump. So the agent must think of her own actions as generated ab initio relative to everything of which she might in principle have knowledge before she acts. So then, putting it somewhat roughly, the causal dependencies are the probabilistic dependencies that survive from the agent's particular and peculiar epistemic perspective. And you see the practical link here. Our causal beliefs are being explained in terms of deliberation, in terms of the special epistemic perspective of the deliberative agent. So what we're explaining is essentially Cartwright's datum, and the broader question is which kind of approach, this pragmatic approach or the metaphysical approach, gives us the better explanation of it. And I say it's the pragmatic approach, which starts with the deliberative practice and the epistemic character of it, and not the metaphysics. Okay, so just to compare the case of causation and indexicals, I think the argument I've just sketched shows us the redundancy of metaphysics in this case. In other words, it shows us that we don't need special kinds of causal facts, distinct from laws of association, in order to account for the difference that Cartwright has rightly called our attention to. But redundancy was only one aspect of the kind of anti-metaphysical point that I drew with respect to explanation in the case of indexicals. The other was the inefficacy. I pointed out that it's very unclear how, even if you did think that there were indexical facts, like a distinguished now, that could have any kind of practical relevance. Now, I don't have time to sort of give you an argument that there's something similar that can be said in this case, but I'll point to a fact which seems to me to provide grounds for optimism. And it's the fact that as two boxers recognized a long time ago, they didn't have a conclusive argument against one boxer's, so the debate quickly became a kind of standoff. And Lewis himself, a famous two-boxer, characterizes it that way in the early 80s. And it seems to me that that standoff is an indication that the metaphysical realist approach in this case can't actually explain the practical deliberation of the kind of counterfactual or causal facts that it thought it was appealing to. If it could do so, it would be able to explain why causal decision theory was a better decision theory than evidential decision theory. Okay, the next point was two kinds of variation. Now, extramodal variation is fairly easy to see in the causal case, I think. We simply need to imagine creatures who are passive observers and not agents. And I think it's plausible that creatures of that kind wouldn't need at least the rich interventionist notion of causation that we actually have as agents. But intramodal variation, I think, is not so easy. And I've suggested in many places that the easiest way to find it is to imagine creatures who have the opposite temporal orientation to ourselves. So perhaps they live in a region of the universe where the thermodynamic arrow has the opposite orientation. Seems to me that highly plausible that those creatures would think of the causal arrow as going in the opposite temporal direction, and that there's no objective sense, no God's eye point of view sense, as it were, in which they're wrong and we are right, or vice versa. There's one other much more familiar place you might look, actually, for this kind of intramodal variation, and that's in various sort of arguments for contextualism about causation. That's an idea which has long seemed to me appealing, but which I haven't ever tried to explore in any detail, but if that worked, it would actually show that intramodal variation for the causal case is actually very common. Okay, the third aspect that it seems to me that we have in this case, and again something I flagged in the indexical case, is what I call local factuality. So I think at least setting aside the contextualism point, the paucity of intramodal variation in the causal case explains why causality seems like such an objective matter to us in just the way predicted by the indexical case. The difference is one of degree. So intramodal variation is extremely common in the indexical case. It's very rare here, again, leaving aside contextualism, but that's just a matter of degree. Okay, so that's why I think that indexicals and causation are simply at different points on the same spectrum. And so, as I put it in the beginning, indexicals are, in a sense, the tip of an iceberg. And what's interesting about the iceberg is the way in which it endangers a certain kind of realistic metaphysics. So here's the big picture to finish up with. Okay, thank you. That's it.
Thank you.
Okay, now that's interesting, and it connects with an issue that came up in the discussion after James's talk yesterday. See, I think all of that stuff can actually be done in terms of hypotheticals and not counterfactuals. So there's nothing counter-legal going on. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think we don't get a kind of reduction to the laws of association. But once we've got this story which, you know, depends so heavily on what you taught me, we have something which is analogous to the kind of explanation that we give in the indexical case. So once again, it's not an analysis. We're not reducing the causal facts to the laws of association. Rather, we're, as it were, explaining why creatures who are located in this sense, that is, decision makers, kind of properly use those properly make those causal judgments. But there doesn't have to be anything in the world other than the laws of association supporting that story. As long as you understand it against the background of that story, then I think it is right. But look, there may be a slightly more accurate way to put it, and something which would be more accurate from my point of view. But that was just a gesture towards the central claim, which is that you don't need to postulate any new kind of ontology. I think there's something I'm not getting. So is the point that as you make those sorts of decisions, you're not thinking of the other people as agents at all? Because what I wanted from a case of intramodal variation is a case in which, as it were, you have two agents. Such that, I think I see what you're getting at. So the point is going to be, in this case, you're in the position of the command economy kind of thing. So as you deliberate, you're not thinking of those agents as causally located, whereas they will. Yes. No. It's an interesting idea. I'll have to think a bit more about whether that's exactly the same thing or something sort of slightly different, but related to it. Do you think you could turn that sort of case into a no-fault disagreement? I mean, what's striking in the indexical case is how easily we turn intramodal differences in location into no-fault disagreements. But it's not obvious to me how that could be done in this case. I mean, one nice thing about the temporal case is if you imagine you could communicate with these creatures in a different part of the universe, and then then you start discussing which way the causation is happening in some region between you, you'll get different answers about the same case. So you get no fault disagreement. No.
That I is actually as universal.
Good.
In the same way that, I'm not saying it well. I'm just saying my suspicion is that in the case of I and in the case of actual, there is no opportunity for sort of extramodal, the kind of extramodal variability that I'm quite willing to countenance for space and time.
Okay. Thank you, Ray. That's some lovely points there. On the case of actuality, in a sense, I'm tempted to say, oh yes, you're absolutely right. Isn't that interesting? Here's a case where extramodal variability can't arise. But on the other hand, I'm kind of tempted to sort of hand it over to the theologians and see if what they can do with it. I'm not sure whether theologians think that God is restricted by being in. By being in one of the possible worlds rather than any other. I mean, that seems a bit sort of cheap to me. There's a kind of escape hole there, I guess. On the other issue, I think we both better not go. I just wanted to respond to the other one. I just didn't make it clear what I meant by the. Well, first of all, I didn't make it clear what I meant by the cloud case. That was supposed to be a case of spatial extramodal variation. So the point about the cloud, it didn't have a spatial location. However, I do think that there are some possible cases of personal extramodal variation. If you think of, as it were, think of a conversation between one of us and a group agent. The group agent doesn't have a personal location. It's not an I in the relevant sense. And so you might be able to construct out of that contrast something where you did have some kind of puzzle which depended precisely on the fact that there was a kind of extramodal variation going on. That's very nice for the spatial case, and presumably you could extend it to the temporal case easily. Whether you could extend it to the, it'd be nice if you could also extend it in an obvious way to the personal case, so that there was, Or maybe that's actually indented and I'm just kind of missing something. But I certainly agree with you that it's a lovely example for kind of freeing up the kind of restrictions we have from the fact that of course we are located in these respects. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure what to say about the that kind of modality, the possible worlds kind of modality. I mean, you may be right that's a case in which Lewis is actually more on my side of the fence than the other side of the fence. As I mentioned very briefly when I had that slide about credence and probability, it's at least arguable that in that case Lewis is on the pragmatist side of the fence, at least compared to some of his opponents. I mean, when he says that, you know, don't tell me. Don't count something as chance unless you can explain why it matters to credence or however he actually puts it. I think in the case of causation, which was my main case, he's not, and that shows up in the fact that he's a two-boxer rather than a one-boxer, and I've got a long paper in which the kind of central theme is that the way to make Lewis consistent and avoid some sort of decision problems that he has within his own approach is to adopt exactly the same kind of pragmatism or subjectivism with respect to causation as he himself adopts with respect to chance. And then you get this nice, elegant picture in which, well, I mean, you rely on this kind of epistemic screaming thing to get rid of the more realistic kinds of Newcomb problems. So in those cases, the evidentialist agrees with the causalist that you should do the equivalent of two-boxing. But in certain extreme kinds of Newcomb problems, it goes the other way, and the right story is that in those cases, the causalist, where causation is understood in this pragmatist way, should agree with the evidentialist that the right thing is to one box.
So, understanding things on the model of indexicals can be seen as a slightly deflationary strategy, and part of the thrust of what you were saying suggested that. But there's a famous problem of how one understands the index, and Lewis's own position was a very radical one, understanding everything as based upon a primitive notion of self-description, where that notion of self-description couldn't be broken down into a two-part notion of description instantiated with the self at the cost of generating exactly the same problems that arose in the first place. So on Lewis's own view, I take it, the answer to the indexical worries takes us to a radically first-personal view of the underlying semantics for all the descriptions. And I was wondering whether you wanted to go that way, so how much the apparent deflationary line of going indexical is underpinned by something that is, in a sense, kind of solipsistic, that takes things back to a primitive self-description.
Yeah. That's a very interesting question, which I don't really have any kind of developed thoughts about, but it's certainly something I have to think about. I wouldn't have actually used the term deflationary myself for this. It was clear that what you were trying to deflate was a certain sort of metaphysical project, but in trying to substitute for it something else, which is a sort of pragmatic explanatory project. But that project is not deflationary in the sense that it thinks there's nothing to say. On the contrary, there's a lot to say. But that's not addressing your main point. I think I'm just gonna take that one on notice. It's very interesting.
Evidential decision theory, you also assign probabilities to acts,
Yeah. No, I perhaps I'm missing something. I mean, the probabilities you need, in my view, are conditional probabilities of states or outcomes on acts, and the story about epistemic screaming doesn't disallow you those. What it does is to ensure that with respect to those, you have independence from your perspective, where a third person would see dependence. But it's all done in terms of conditional probabilities. And so I don't think that there's any tension there with the stuff about epistemic screening. Exactly. Exactly. You know, about that.
You just have to sort of ask yourself, well, what do I feel inclined to do? There's all sorts of that extreme possible. But Newcomb's problem is designed exactly in such a way that I can't get the same.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I agree. I present it in the paper that I mentioned in response to Alistair. I present it by analogy with the cases of inadmissible evidence that come up in discussions of the principal principle. Remember that Lewis says that the principal principle specifies the constraint that your beliefs about chances place on your rational credences, except in cases where you have inadmissible evidence, the kind of information you get from a crystal ball about what's going to happen, the actual outcome of a chancy process. It seems to me that cases of inadmissible evidence are very much like the kind of core Newcomb problems, not the kind of semi-realistic ones, which I agree with you and cite you in dismissing, but the core, the residual ones. Now, in the case of inadmissible evidence, you might imagine a kind of table thumping realist about chance who says that even in that case, we should, our credences should just follow the chances. It's irrational to do anything else. The worlds with crystal balls are just worlds in which irrational people tend to do better. So as far as I know, nobody actually takes that position, but it's a possible position in the landscape. And that's the position that I want to compare to a certain kind of objectivist about causation, who hasn't got a story, as Lewis hasn't got a story, about why causation matters in deliberation, but just is driven by this intuition, that the kind of intuition that goes into the usual counterfactuals. And I want to oppose to that a more subjectivist kind of person about causation, who says that these Newcomb problems are problems in which the causal facts understood in my subjectivist way are not as they seem to be. The analog of that in the case of chance is someone like Ned Hall, who thinks that the cases Lewis describes as cases of inadmissible evidence are not cases in which the chances are normal and we have weird evidence. They're cases in which the chances are weird. So we don't need any restrictions on the principle. All we need to recognize is that if the world is weird, the chances may be weird too. And that's what I want to say about the Newcomb problem. I want to say The kind of classic Newcomb problem is a case in which the world is weird in this evidential way, and the best kind of moral to draw from that is that the causal facts are weird, so that causal decision theory, like evidential decision theory, they're really the same thing in that case, recommends one boxing. Now, of course, j- just as you, I mean, just as you can kind of occupy Lewis's position in the case of chance, you can occupy a corresponding position in the case of causation. But in the case of chance, nobody thinks that the rationality goes with that more objective view of chance. On the contrary, Lewis himself thinks it's obvious that, of course, you need the exclusion to the principal principle. What's interesting about the causal case is that nobody sees the kind of parallel move there, which is to think that it's obvious that the rationality goes with the evidential case there. And that if you want to have a view of causation, say if you want to stipulate that there can't be retrocausality, so that there can't be causation in the kind of classic Newcomb problem, sure you can use causation in that way if you like, but then you shouldn't think that rationality goes with causation in such a strange case. You should do exactly what Lewis does in the case of inadmissible evidence. In the version of it which can't be treated in a semi-realistic way, where causation is understood in this subjectivist way, yeah. It's not entirely precise.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm wondering how deep the iceberg runs in your view. Because I think it runs very deep, but I can see how you might extend a picture of this to epistemic modals quite easily, which can seem like they maybe even are indexable, if not indexable, it's very much like indexable. And also, a lot of deontic modalities seem similar insofar as they're relative to certain legal systems or certain standards or certain ends, although in the deontic case, I think something we want to hold out for an all things considered ought or must. So I was wondering what you think about, does it also run that deep, this picture, and further than something like the logical modalities? It's logically necessary that principle non-contradiction is true. Could we have no fault disagreement about something like that? Or do you want to say even that's a kind of modality that's somehow similar?
Yeah, I mean, that last point, I think, is a very interesting one. And I think it's related to that issue that Simon Blackburn discusses in the Morals and Modals paper. You know, he talks about the residuals where you don't seem to be able to make sense of a certain kind of variability with respect to modals of that kind, that you can make sense of the moral case. So I'm just going to set that aside. What's issue? I mean, really, I should have said causation there instead of modal. I mean, what's interesting about that case is that, a combination of several things. One is that there's so many people around who have strong realist intuitions about it. Another is that we have something which I think can be seen as a kind of analog of the Anscombe-Perry point, namely the Cartwright, what I call the Cartwright two-boxer thesis. So that makes it a particularly kind of fruitful one for applying this kind of methodology. I think in the case of some of the other kinds of modals, people who are sort of realist in that sense are perhaps harder to find. So the opponents are not around. But my intuition would be to say that it's the same iceberg. It's just not going to be threatening. I mean, it's threatening there, but not so much in other places.
Any more questions? Well, we're going to think about a.